Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. It is another great edition of Homefront. You are listening to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I am your host, Cynthia Davis, and we're going to spend the next hour delving into life's most perplexing problems and hopefully coming up with great answers. I appreciate you joining me tonight. It looks like we've got one of our favorite guests tonight. Dave, is that you want to say hello to everybody?
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Hey, it's a great Tuesday night. We're about to talk about our favorite topics, Missouri grassroots stuff.
Yeah, I hear you got Bill coming along tonight.
He will be joining us, and he has authored many books, and we have a lot of, frankly, if anybody wants to call in, this is your opportunity to become educated on any topic you want. He has a vast amount of information on just about anything you want to ask. We're going to talk tonight about, he's got a couple books. We're going to try and limit it to just Backfired and his book on everything you needed to know about the Koran. There, obviously, the news has been dominated in the last few weeks with the tragedy in Boston. And, you know, I was a little nervous about what do I put for my code words as we identify the show and what we're going to talk about, because people are still very nervous about, you know, I don't know if I should use the word bomb. But that's the question is we are, our nation once again was attacked, and it's time for us to look intelligently at what happened, why it happened, how it happened, and what are we going to do to protect ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. And I for one am not as concerned that people might or might not want to use the word bomb. I don't care whether they use bomb or IED or explosive device. I'm really concerned, Cynthia, though, and I'm sure you and Bill will get into this tonight, about the fact that people seem too concerned to use the word Arab or Muslim or terrorist.
No kidding. One of the earlier reports I heard, actually, they were describing the problem as caused by there were people who did this for religious reasons.
Yeah.
Now, once you start saying that, what you're really trying to do is make it sound like anybody shouldn't have any religious reason to do anything. After all, those are the people who could bomb people. And
right.
The whole MIAC report was designed around trying to lump Christians and Muslims and Hindus and anybody who has any faith in anything as being bad people. And the secularists and the atheists then is really the only correct position to hold, at least publicly, or else you're going to freak people out. I am sad that it's come to this point. If you remember back on 9/11, what happened that made that different? Well, yes, 9/11 was a terrible tragedy for our country. It was a day of darkness and sadness and grieving. But out of the ashes, we had an opportunity to have one small glimpse at the American spirit. And for the first time in decades, we saw Americans holding hands together, getting off of all that partisan bickering and saying, we're Americans. You saw an emergence of patriotism. We have not seen. Now, I own a retail store, Back to Basics Christian Bookstore. What I sell are American flags among books. I sell books and gifts. The day after 9/11, not only did all my customers clean me out of all my American flags, but I called my flag company to order more, and they were wiped out. So
cool.
This is the first time we really have seen people come together and say, I want to display the flag. In my lifetime, when you and I were kids, was when America was still going through the Vietnam era, and there was this, the soldiers were coming home from Vietnam, and our country behaved shamefully toward them. Patriotism was at an all-time low, and it was sad to watch how we treated those who went to defend us. We were very confused and conflicted. Here we are today. Today, we're going down again. But on 9/11, that was a time when America really shone, when we had beauty in our spirit, and our coming together was something that really was exquisite. I didn't see that happen this time. Obviously, we have a different man occupying the White House.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
What is your take on the way America reacted to the Boston problem?
Well, I'm in agreement with you, and I believe that the crux of that issue, quite frankly, is what you said. I think it's leadership, and don't get me wrong, I'm not here to hold George Bush up to any high standard, because he was not one of my favorite presidents of all time, but he was a drawing together leader at that time. He was a person who stood up and took command of the situation, and between him and Rudy Giuliani drew people, no matter who they were, into the fold. And we have a divisive leader now. We have a leader who uses him and his whole administration use items like this to, as Uncle Rom said, you know, to not let any good crisis go to waste.
Well, you're right. It looks like we do have Bill Federer joining us now. And Bill, thank you for coming on the radio with us tonight.
Cynthia, great to be with you.
Yeah, we were talking about your reputation as preceding you as being such a having vast knowledge and experience on any topic we can come up with this evening. But I was telling them about where were you on 9/11, and we were reflecting on how the Congress walked out to the steps of our Capitol and held hands and sang God Bless America. I didn't hear anybody singing God Bless America in this Boston attack. What a different tone. Are you feeling the different tone?
Yes, definitely. And I think the Boston bombing can be looked at on two levels. One is the Islamic Jihad that the young perpetrators were involved in, and the importance of understanding that Muhammad was the perfect Muslim. And so Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they're wanting to be like him. So if we can understand Muhammad's life, we can understand the plan, the goal of those who are wanting to copy him. And I actually wrote a book. It's called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. And so Muhammad's life went through three stages. He was a religious leader for 12 years in the pagan city of Mecca, and only made 70 converts. He gets a little bit confrontational and tells these pagans that they're going to burn in hell. And so the pagans in Mecca decide that he's disturbing the peace, and they chase him out of town in the year 622 AD. So Muhammad flees north 210 miles to a Jewish city called Medina. And the Jews are nice enough to let him in as an immigrant, a refugee, and he presents his faith, but they reject it. And so Muhammad goes into the minority neighborhoods in Medina and begins to organize a little following. And a few resist, and they mysteriously get assassinated, and the rest join. And so now Muhammad goes back to the Jewish leaders with this following, and he presents himself sort of like a candidate of change, that he's a newcomer to the city, and he can rise above their partisanship. And so they make a treaty, and now Muhammad is a political leader as well as a religious leader. And then something happens. Muhammad's followers in Mecca get a little pushy, argumentative, and threatening, the way some of his followers are today. And they get chased out of town. And Muhammad considers them the victims. And so Muhammad allows them to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town. And so where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, Muhammad taught retaliation. If they chase you out, you attack their caravans. Muhammad got a whole chapter of the Quran on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. It's Surah 8, Chapter 8. And so in the year 624 A.D., the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 defeats 1,000. And this amazing victory convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And he fights in 66 battles in the next 8 years before he dies. He even used the catapult when he attacked a city called Al-Ta'if. And when he was told the catapult was killing innocent women and children, his response was, they are among them. So suicide bombers today, like the Boston bomber, think it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since Muhammad is the perfect Muslim, Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they want to be like him religiously, politically, and militarily. And we have 1,400 years of track record to observe Muslims following this example. And so in the year 627 AD, the Meccans send 10,000 soldiers to Medina, and Muhammad's version of roadside bombs and IEDs was he dug potholes and trenches all around the city of Medina, which rendered the superior cavalry of the Meccans useless. You can't charge your horse and camel across a field full of potholes and trenches. They'll break their legs. And so Muhammad goes to some of these pagan tents at nighttime, and he bribes them, and they slip away. And he goes to some of the other pagan tribes, and he bribes them and threatens them, and they slip away. And then it gets freezing cold for a week, and the Meccans lose heart and decide to bring their troops home. And when they bring their troops home, instead of Muhammad becoming peaceful, instead he's emboldened that his enemies were cowards, and they couldn't subdue him. So he goes back into the Jewish city of Medina, and he gets offended at one of the tribes, confiscates their property, chases them out of town, gets offended at the second Jewish tribe, confiscates their property, chases them out of town. And this set a precedent in Islam called hudna, which means when you're weak, you make treaties until you get strong enough to disregard them. So when he first came to Medina, and he was that sort of community organizer type, and he had a following, and the Jews made a treaty with him, so he was weak, but now he's strong. He just defeated the only people that could come to the Jews' rescue. And so he breaks the treaties and chases them out of town. But the third Jewish tribe in Medina, Muhammad bottles them in their neighborhood for 25 days. When they finally surrender, he brings them into the market and chops off their heads, 600 or 700, and then sells the women and children into slavery.
That doesn't sound like a very nice thing to do.
And matter of fact, this begins the enslavement of over 180 million Africans in the 1,400 years of Islam. Muhammad was white. There are hadith that say when he would lift his armpits in prayer, they would see the whiteness of his armpits. But he owned African slaves. And anyway, within 5 years of Muhammad coming into the Jewish city of Medina, there is not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They were either chased out, killed, or enslaved. And so the three-step process is immigrate as a religious person, increase the number of your followers amongst minorities, and then you eliminate the previous culture. And so there are 751 neighborhoods around Paris, France, that have been completely taken over by 5 million Muslims. And you think, how did they take over these neighborhoods? The first ones came in as religious immigrants, and then they increased the number of their followers and also have a higher birth rate, and then they would eliminate the previous French culture, neighborhood by neighborhood. And so Muhammad's the number one name given to newborns in London, Milan, Brussels. Most of southern Holland is now Moroccan Muslim. 10 years ago, there were 3 mosques in Germany. Today, there's 200. 10% of Berlin, Germany is Turkish Muslim. The number one crime in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark is rape. Muslim immigrant men raping European women because Muhammad permitted his men to rape the women they took in battle. And
where
so we
is
see,
that?
That's Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And,
oh, my goodness.
So we see that it is a three-step process on how to take over. And again, there's 1,400 years of track record. So Syria is in the news today. Syria was the first country to completely be Christian, evangelized by Paul, and Antioch, Syria, was where the name Christian was first used. Jerusalem had been a Byzantine Christian city for 3 centuries, since Constantine, till Caliph Umar invaded. And then Egypt had been evangelized by Mark, that wrote the Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It was Coptic Christian for 6 centuries until Amir ibn al-As invaded. And then there used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century. Everything that is Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, and Libya used to be Christian Catholic. St. Augustine of Hippo was from Carthage, which is Tunisia. But then the Muslims conquered. And then in the year 711, 80,000 Muslims crossed the Strait of Gibraltar and conquered Spain. And they had the scimitar sword and the stirrup and the Arabian horses, where the Europeans were still fighting on foot with heavy metal swords that took two hands. So in 10 years, the Muslims conquer Spain. They cross the Pyrenees. They conquer southern France. Pope Gregory puts out a plea that anybody that could fight should join Charles Martel. Charles Martel gets 30,000 volunteers, and they're all on foot. He puts them on top of a hill in a complete square. And when the Muslims attack and charge into the square, they get stuck. And then Martel had arranged for some of his men to sneak into the Muslim camp and free the captives. And as the booty was being let go from the Muslim camp, the commander of the Muslims tries to rally them back, and he gets distracted and killed. Now the Muslims can't decide who their next commander is going to be, so they pick up and go back to Spain. And that gives Charles Martel 5 years to learn how to make a stirrup and learn how to teach his men how to fight on horseback. And 5 years later, they win their first battle. And this begins the Reconquista, where it took 700 years to drive the Muslims out of Spain. But that battle at Tours was 732 A.D., exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 A.D. And then the Turks convert to Islam, and they invade what is today Turkey, but back then it was the Byzantine Christian Empire. So all seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were all wiped out by the Muslims. Ephesus, Colossae, Galatia, Antioch, wiped out. And then the Greeks call for the West to come and help. And the West sends help. It's called the what? The Crusades.
What?
Right?
Okay.
And nine major Crusades in 200 years. Richard the Lionheart led the Third Crusade, left his brother King John in charge of England. That's the taxes, Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood, you know, during the Third Crusade. And then a trivia question, who led the Seventh and Eighth Crusades against the Muslims?
Who? Okay, don't make me look bad in front of my audience.
St. Louis.
Okay, I was about to say that.
St. Louis was King Louis the Ninth, and you can see him on his crusader horse at Art Hill. That's when he was going off to fight the Seventh and Eighth Crusades against the Muslims. And he was the most powerful monarch in Europe.
And he won, didn't he?
He won one sort of, and then the other one he didn't. He won several battles in Egypt, and then they lured him further into Egypt, and then they broke the dikes and the levees, and the river flooded his army. And so he, you know, sort of messed up on that second crusade of his. And but nevertheless, there were many crusades, but they ended up ending. And when the crusades ended, the Muslims picked up where they left off, and they conquered Constantinople in the year 1453. Now, Constantinople was where the capital of Rome was. Constantine had moved it there from Rome in 313. It's where the Black Sea empties into the Mediterranean. And so the Muslims.
So Rome, just so we get this straight for our audience, Rome was part of Italy, right?
Right.
And he moved the Vatican?
No, there's Italy and the city of Rome, but there's the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire was all of Spain, France, Gaul, Germany. It was all of Turkey, all the Middle East, all of Egypt, all of North Africa. That was all the Roman Empire. And there was Roman emperors. And the different tribes were invading into Rome, the Visigoths and Ostrogoths and Attila the Hun and ever, Constantine, just prior to that, moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople, which today is called Istanbul, but Constantinople was this big planned capital city where the Black Sea empties into the Mediterranean Sea, and it's where the East and West met. And it grew into the New York, Washington, D.C., capital of Europe for 1,000 years. So Rome was trashed by the Visigoths and, really didn't come back till centuries later. But Constantinople, it continued. And they even had somewhat of an invincibility complex. They thought they were God's special city and that God would never abandon them. Unfortunately, they had politics. And one emperor died without choosing a son to replace him, and so the two sons sort of had it out, and The one son, Demetrius, goes across the Bosporus, this river that connects the Black Sea to the Mediterranean, and he gathers the Muslim hordes and brings them across to the walls of Constantinople to try to, challenge his brother for leadership. And these Muslim hordes are like, we don't need this Demetrius guy. We'll just do this ourselves. And so they were fighting their Democrat-Republican battle, you know, trying to use the Muslims for our side or the other side, not realizing that the Muslims are their own political party. And they'll use whatever one they can to get in the advantage. But then finally someone was bribed to leave the gates of Constantinople open. And the Muslims charge in 80,000. And they butchered, killed, raped, you know, they just take over. And the Europeans dropped their jaws. They couldn't believe this eternal city of Constantinople is now in Muslim hands. And so the year it happened was 1453. And so this ended the land trade routes to get from Europe over to India and China. Europeans traded with India and China from Roman times. Even Marco Polo, the guy from Venice, the kids play the game, Marco Polo, around the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Marco Polo in 1271 went with his dad and uncle to China and worked for Kublai Khan, brought back spaghetti, coal, gunpowder, talked about Kublai Khan inventing paper currency. And unfortunately, he printed too much of it, and the Mongolian Empire there fell. But nevertheless, trade went on. But when the Muslims conquered the trade routes, it ended the trade. And so that's when the Portuguese tried to get over to India and China by sailing around South Africa in 1496, Vasco da Gama. But in 1492, a guy named Columbus said, I know a shortcut to India and China, sail west. He runs into some islands. He thinks he's in India, so he names the inhabitants the Indians. Think of it. We would not even call Native Americans Indians if it was not for Islamic Jihad. I mean, Columbus gave him that name. Well, why did Columbus give him that name? He thought he was in India. Well, why was Columbus trying to get to India? The Muslims, 40 years earlier, had cut off the land routes to India. Anyway, so finally, in 1521, 100,000 Muslims surround Vienna, Austria, under Suleiman the Magnificent. They control the Mediterranean. We have the Knights of Malta to try to hold them off, but they're invading the coast of Italy. Tens of thousands are taken captive from Italy, Spain, Portugal. There are entire Catholic orders in Europe called the Trinitarians, and the head of the order is called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations across Europe and go under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back who was captured by the Muslims. In the year 846, 10,000 Muslims invaded Rome, Italy, and they went up to the Basilica of St. Peter's, and they trashed it, and they trashed the bones of St. Peter. And then the Muslims went to the Chapel of St. Paul, and they trashed the bones of St. Paul. And then later they were going to trash the bones of St. Nicholas, and so the Greeks move them over from the Asia Minor, Turkey area, over to Italy. They were going to trash the bones of St. Mark's in Egypt, and so they moved his bones over to Venice, so that's St. Mark's Cathedral. Anyway, and then in the year, they captured one of the pilgrim ships in 1625. The pilgrims had saved up 800 pounds of beaver skins and sent it back to Europe to trade for supplies, and the Muslims captured it in the English Channel, took it to Morocco, and sold the crew into slavery. In the year 1630, the Muslims captured an entire Irish village, the stolen village of Baltimore, Ireland, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. And then they captured 400 from Reykjavik, Iceland, around 1637, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. And so when America broke from Britain, the first war was the Barbary Pirate War with the Muslim pirates from Barbary and Morocco and Tripoli. And that's when Thomas Jefferson got fed up and sent in our Marines. And so we have this long, long history of military conquest that there are Muslims, Persian, Arab, Turkish, and the military conquest that they have done, and they think that they are following the example of Muhammad and the rightly guided caliphs, and the Muslim Brotherhood, whom our government is arming over there in Syria. The Muslim Brotherhood has stated their goal is a one-world government underneath of one Muslim leader called the Caliph. And so here we are using our military arms to unseat all these dictators. And as bad as dictators are, and I can't defend dictators, but as bad as they are, the Christians at least get to exist. under the Muslim Brotherhood, the Christians are getting killed right and left, and our country is doing nothing to lift a finger against it. Anyway, this is all happening right now. And there's more slavery today than any other time in world history, and a whole lot of it is in Muslim countries. And so with that in mind, when these Muslims that did the Boston bombing, instead of saying, oh, these are just lone people that have, you know, twisted a peaceful religion, actually they're following very closely the example of Muhammad and the rightly guided caliphs. And Islam is a religion of peace. But the question is, what is the definition of the word peace? You and I define it as different groups getting along. Fundamental Islam defines peace as when the whole world submits to the will of Allah, there will be peace. Now, a moderate Muslim thinks the world will submit to Allah later, maybe at the end of the world, maybe it's figurative, and since it's so far in the distant future, just get along with the kafir infidel and have your life. The fundamental Muslim thinks the world is supposed to submit to Allah now, and they're really excited and they want to help make it happen, like those bombers. Now, the dilemma for us in the West is we think that, sort of like a football game, we think if we can just let them get a first down, they'll be nice and they'll let us get a first down. So we let them get a first down. What do? They get more excited. And they're not letting us have a turn. So what do we say? Well, let's just let them get a touchdown. Then they'll get it out of their system and they'll let us get a touchdown. Or we let them get a touchdown, another one, thinking that sometime they're going to reciprocate. And instead, they're getting more excited. And they're rallying and they're packing out the stadium and they're cheering and they're painting their faces. And we're like, gee, why are they getting so excited? Why are they getting radicalized? Why are these Muslims getting radicalized? It's like, hello. You know, if your team is winning, why do you want to, you know, stop supporting them? And so, anyway, so that's the first level to observe the Boston bombers, is the understanding of Islam being a religious system, a political system, and a military system. So, yes, it is a religion, but not just a religion, because Muhammad was not just a religious leader.
Let me ask you this, though. We saw the face of a precious 8-year-old boy who was killed. We saw the senseless people, why people would lose their limbs for the rest of their lives. People now have no arms and no legs. There were a lot of people who were very seriously injured. And in our American mentality, we're trying to get our heads around, why would anybody hurt somebody who did no harm to them? This, obviously, an 8-year-old child is incapable of having done any harm to Muslims. He probably doesn't even know who they are. And so in our American way of life, we can't imagine how blowing up a bomb or two bombs made out of pressure cookers, how did that further the cause of Muslim? All that did was make them look very evil.
Well, Muhammad used terror attacks, and he would have his soldiers on horseback ride into some unarmed village and kill some people. I mean, they could literally slice them in half with their scimitar swords, and the whole town would get terrorized, afraid, and submit. And so the word Islam means submission. And so he would have his warriors go up to the walls of the city and say, we offer you peace. If you want peace, embrace Islam. If you're not going to embrace Islam, then that means you don't want peace, and we'll give you the sword. Now, they did invent, when they conquered Jerusalem, a third category called dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, dhimmi. It's a second-class status for Christians and Jews, where you can't pray out loud, you can't ring church bells, you can't ride a donkey, you can't own a weapon, you can't hold a job superior to a Muslim. You have to pay the annual jizya tax, in other words, ransom your life once a year, sort of like protection money the Chicago Mafia would demand. It's very similar to the way the freed slaves were treated in the Deep South after the Civil War. So we had Republican Lincoln freeing the slaves. The Democrats in the South were freed the slaves, but afterwards they passed Jim Crow laws and black codes, which relegated these freed slaves to a second-class status. And that's a horrible chapter that these Democrats passed in the South. They started the KKK and so forth. But nevertheless, that is the way Christians are treated today in these Muslim countries. So in Cairo, Egypt, Christians are called garbage people because they can never hold a job higher than a Muslim, and they spend their day digging through garbage trying to eke out a living. You go to all these countries over there, the Christians are just getting killed and slaughtered, and our government is arming the Muslim Brotherhood that's doing it. And
I see pictures of Muslim women wearing the full robes all over them, and
my wife saw two women in Grasso Plaza just today wearing the burqa.
And it really is a symbol of oppression. It makes you wonder, why would any woman want to be a part of an oppression like that, where they're treated like second-class citizens and not allowed to have all the freedom we have? I mean, there's not, I don't know of any man who would insist his wife cover up and go out covered, you know, in what's just, it, for us it would be embarrassing, because it's going to get hot here in a little bit. Summer's on its way.
Well, it's the women, number one, they don't decide to do it. Their husband decides for them. And then the husband doesn't decide to do it. It's the imam that decides for the husband. It's not a religion of free choice. It's a religion where you obey the imam. And anyway, it's it has the same psychological effect of gang colors. So if a gang starts showing themselves visible in a neighborhood with gang colors and spray paint and mailboxes and so forth, what happens? People feel a little unsettled and they want to move out of the neighborhood. And the property values go down, and then more of the gang can move into the neighborhood. And so it's part of the process. I mentioned those two cities Muhammad lived in, Mecca mm-hmm. and Medina. In Mecca, Muhammad was just a religious leader. In Medina, Muhammad transitioned to a political and a military leader. And so the verses Muhammad got from his Allah when he was in Mecca are just religious verses, and they're a little more peaceful. The verses Muhammad got in Medina are the political military verses, and they are more violent, like cut off the head of the infidel and lay in wait for them, and you know, chop off arms and legs if they steal and so forth. And the later verses supersede the earlier verses. So by comparison, in the Bible, there's an Old Testament that has violence with Moses wiping and Joshua wiping out the tribes, you know, in the Holy Land. And then the New Testament, Jesus and the apostles didn't kill anybody. And so what do we as Christians say? WWJD, what would Jesus do? And we say the later verses supersede the earlier ones. The later ones are the ones we're trying to imitate, not the killing ones. Well, it's the same way in Islam, only in reverse. Their peaceful verses came first. They're called weak verses when he was in Mecca. And they're superseded by the later verses that are called strong verses that he got in Medina. And so the fundamental Muslims say, look, those are the last verses that Muhammad got, and that's what we're supposed to do. And but those two cities he lived in are the two plans that the Muslim Brotherhood has been using. The first city of Mecca, Muhammad was just religious, and so the Muslim Brotherhood, their plan for their first phase of takeover is just be a religious Muslim. Go into these countries and just be religious, and just be nice and get along, but be religious. And as soon as you get into positions of authority and into positions in the community and everything, that's when they say it's time to move to the Medina phase, and they become political and military, and they have takeovers. Remember a couple years ago, there was this unexplainable, seemingly coordinated Arab Spring, where all of these Muslim countries decided to overthrow their leaders. Well, mm-hmm. what happened was is the Muslim Brotherhood had been quietly for a generation infiltrating all those countries with their quote-unquote fundamental Muslims religiously, and then they sent out the signal that it's time to move from the Mecca phase to the Medina phase. So the peaceful part of Muhammad's life to the political and military and the violent part of Muhammad's life. And they all did it at once. And we're scratching our heads over in America saying, gee, why are they all going to get rid of their, you know, President Mubarak in Egypt and all these different things? And we couldn't really explain why. Well, it was the Muslim Brotherhood that organized it all. And
you're right. I mean, we can see it in hindsight much easier now, but what we're, I'm got your book here in my hand called Backfired, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance is No Longer Tolerating Religion. And the question is, I've got a book on the shelves in my bookstore called Who Stole My Church? And I can see us asking another question now, who stole our country? Because we're at a point now where we are losing our religious freedom. And when I listen to the reports about the Boston Marathon, the first question a lot of us here in the middle of the country may have wondered is, what city are they going to attack next? And then they made the comment on the news that this was done by religious people. And when a newscaster tries to paint it that way, what they're really doing is saying, let's not tolerate anybody being religious anymore, because after all, they might be bombers.
Yeah, it's sort of an argument that really holds no water. Them saying, well, gee, all religions are the same. There's two ways to answer that. One is to say, well, gee, I guess all political parties are the same. We ban all political parties. Right? All these parties, they're all bald, just ban them all. Well, no, we need to look at what they teach. Hello? You know, what do they stand for? So we need to look at Islam and Christianity and say, instead of saying, well, you know, Christians have had some violent people, Muslims have some violent people, everybody's got some kooks, so let's just get on with it. No. If your computer acts up, what do? Well, Control-Alt-Delete. If it really acts up, you reload the software the way it was when it came from the factory. So if your religion acts up, what do? You go back to the way it was when it left the factory, the founder. So let's compare the founders, Jesus and Muhammad. Jesus never killed anybody. Muhammad killed an estimated 3,000 people, including cutting off the heads of those 700 Jews in Medina. Jesus never owned slaves. Muhammad got a fifth of the slaves taken in battle. Jesus never tortured anyone. Muhammad conquered the city of Kaibar. It was an oasis, the last Jewish settlement in Arabia. And the Jewish chief refused to tell where the tribe's treasure was hidden in the desert. Muhammad had him stretched out on the ground and they kindled a fire on his chest. He still wouldn't tell, so Muhammad had him beheaded. Jesus never permitted his apostles to rape anyone. Muhammad did, and there's always hadith that talk about how to do it because they were stopping short of getting him pregnant because they could sell him for more in the marketplace, and Muhammad said, don't stop. And Jesus never forced anyone to follow him. He said something difficult. Many disciples walked with him no more. Muhammad said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. Jesus forgave insults. He's dying on the cross saying, Father, forgive him. Muhammad avenged insults. He had the guy named Ibn Khattal had made up poems making fun of Muhammad, and two slave girls recited the poems, and Muhammad was insulted by the poems, so he ordered them murdered. Jesus taught God was our father. In Islam, it's blasphemy to call Allah your father. Jesus taught we're children of God. In Islam, it's blasphemy to say you're a child of Allah. Jesus taught we're made in the image of God. In Islam, Allah has no image. Jesus taught to have a personal relationship with God. In Islam, it's blasphemy to even want to have a personal relationship with Allah because he's transcendent and unknowable. The first 3 centuries of Christianity, there were 10 major persecutions and Christians were thrown to the lions. They never led an armed resistance against the Roman emperor. The first 3 centuries of Islam, they conquered from Arabia to Paris. You know, and those that say, well, gee, well, we're all worshiping the same God. It's like, well, here's one for you. Christianity says that you need to believe in Jesus to go to heaven. Islam has an unforgivable sin called shirk, and it will condemn you to hell, and believing in Jesus is shirk. And so how can the same God say, if you believe in Jesus, you go up, and if you believe in Jesus, you go down? Either God is schizophrenic or we're talking about two different gods.
Yeah.
Islam permits lying. It's called taqiyya, sacred lying, holy deceit. Muhammad had a warrior who was captured, and he was forced to renounce Muhammad. He later escaped and went back to Muhammad, and Muhammad forgave him. And Muhammad said, if they make you turn, turn, but don't turn in your heart. In other words, it's okay to deny Muhammad in a pinch to save your skin, as long as you don't fight against Islam. In other words, it's okay to say you're not a Muslim in order to get elected, but then everything you do once you're elected is to help advance Islam. Jesus did not permit lying. He said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And in Revelations it says the people that don't go into the New Jerusalem are all the liars and whoremongers and so forth. You know, he that telleth a lie, you know, will not be let in. And so the Allah of Islam permits lying if you can advance Islam. It's called taqiyya, sacred lying. But the God of the Bible is against lying. And there's a commandment, thou shalt not, you know, lie and bear false witness,
yeah,
and so forth.
Huge problems. But what we're observing now happening to our country is the question of we're losing our religious freedoms. Every
right.
day it seems like if you don't have the government, and when I was in the Missouri House of Representatives, I tried to have the bill drafting department put together a nice little resolution for me, and I used for the there was a group of, it was the St. Charles County homeschoolers that were having a graduation, and I put some reference in there to God, and I got a letter from them saying they can't do that. And so, of course, I marched up to the Speaker of the House's office, and I said, we've got a small problem here. And he corrected them, and we did, they did allow it to happen. But it was worth going through the exercise, because if we don't push back, we're going to come to a day very soon when nobody's allowed to even mention, you know, we've got the National Day of Prayer coming up this Thursday, and we're at a point again where if we don't use our opportunity, there may become a day when we're going to lose the privilege and really a right to pray openly in public. So
yeah,
here's
you're
my...
right. Go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, no, I think we have to have the conversation, because while we're seeing we had a discussion when we were debating the prayer in school bill on the floor of the Missouri House of Representatives, and there was a Muslim representative who stood up and tried to make the case that they like to pray very loud, and there are some cities in Michigan where they actually allow Muslims to pray over a loudspeaker, which is noise pollution, frankly, for those who don't want to join in. And what they're doing is pushing the level to the point where their right to freedom of religion is going to conflict with our right to freedom of religion, and then what are we going to do?
Islam is not just a religion. It is important that we understand that it is also a political and a military system, because Muhammad was not just a religious leader, he was a political and a military leader. So if we set the religion part aside and look at Islam from a political and a military point of view, it's very similar to if the Bloods and the Crips and the MS-13 gang takes over a neighborhood and they begin to practice their laws, their lynchings, their pimps, their prostitutes. And should the police throw up their hands and say, well, gee, you've taken over the neighborhood, you can just practice your laws there? That wouldn't make sense, would it? What if the KKK and the mafia took over a neighborhood and the police threw up their hands and said, well, you can go ahead and have your gangland justice and your killings and so forth. So if someone joins your gang but then they decide to leave the gang, you can kill them, and, you know, you can use your intimidation tactics, and you know, you can have polygamy or whatever you want. You know, if the Mormons took over a neighborhood, you can have polygamy. And is our government supposed to throw up the hands? And so when Sharia law political Muslims move into a neighborhood, they say, well, you know what, we want to have polygamy. We want to be able to beat our wives. We want to be able to do honor killings on our daughter if she leaves Islam. We want to have the halal food, not the haram food. We want to do this and that. That wouldn't make sense. I mean, from a political military, it's no different than Nazism and communism, because it is totalitarian control. I mean, what if Hitler would have simply said, Nazism is a religion? Would we have said, oh, excuse me, it's a religion? We'll teach it in our schools that Jews are untermenschen. And so if all you got to do is wave a flag that says religion and you get a free pass to organize politically and militarily take over, that wouldn't make any sense. And so Muhammad, again, is the perfect Muslim. And Muhammad's life went through three stages. He was a religious leader. He was a political leader. He was a military leader. And since he is the perfect Muslim, Islam today is a religious system, a political system, and a military system. A mosque is a religious building, a political building, and a military building. Bowing to Mecca is a religious bowing, a political bowing, and a military pledging of allegiance to another capital. There is no way to split the religious from the political military unless you're going to split Muhammad. I mean, which Muslim on planet Earth has the authority to say we are no longer going to imitate Muhammad's Meccan, Medina period of his life? We're just going to imitate him when he was a Meccan, in the city of Mecca. There's no Muslim that can say, okay, he was right in Mecca, he was wrong in Medina.
So you're getting into the problem of where you're saying that the government precedes and is superior to religion.
Phrase that again.
Well, if we either part of the reason a lot of Christians have their bravery is because they believe that God's law is higher than man's law. And so our government respects Christianity and allowing people to, let's say, not have to work on Sunday or violate their conscience. We still have a few conscience clauses in our laws, but we've allowed it based on a Christian ethic. And if we apply it generally to everyone, then the concern is that the Muslims will say, what happens when they say our law to God, our Allah, is more important than civil laws?
Well, that's a good point, and it's important to understand that the Judeo-Christian belief system is the one that believes that everybody's equal. Islam has no concept of equality. That Allah loves the Muslim, Allah hates the infidel. That it takes two women to testify against one man. A woman gets half the inheritance that a man gets. A man can have four wives, a woman cannot have four husbands. I mean, there is no equality in Islam. Equality began in Israel with the law, and everybody was equal before the law. Rich, poor, even the stranger living amongst them, men and women, the law applies to everybody, and the law says that, Book of Genesis, that everybody is made in the image of God. And so if you're equal before God, then you're equal before the law. Islam does not have that. Islam is totalitarian. It controls every aspect of your life. And so America, in our declaration, where it says all men are created equal, you've just eliminated Islam. Islam does not believe all men are created equal. Go ahead.
No, I want to. We're running out of time, and I'm so thrilled that you're giving us all this wonderful information. But I wanted to actually get into economics for a minute and talk about, the economy is not as strong as it was a decade ago. We're still seeing depression in some areas severely, and our country is faltering. We're seeing taxes become oppressive, and I wanted to know, has any country ever reversed itself in the way it taxes its people without a revolution or a revival?
Margaret Thatcher, there were 70% income tax rates in Britain, and she took a tremendous amount of negative press when she slashed income taxes, revived the economy. She privatized a whole lot of this huge government bureaucracy doing all kinds of stuff, and it gave Britain another step away from the brink of bankruptcy. At the time the country was founded, there was an alignment of the stars. In other words, the richest people in America and the common people in America both wanted freedom. And so imagine if the richest people in America, we're working together as part of our group as patriots. Boy, we'd really have a shot in the arm there. What happened was, I've identified five things and then six. Five things have driven business out of a country and caused their loyalties to leave with them. So higher taxes here than there, there being China and India and so forth. More lawsuits here than there. Higher union wages here than there. It's just a fact. More government regulations here than there. More environmental restrictions here than there. I mean, it's just a fact. There's less in China. And, you know, if anything, we should have an incentive where businesses can get deductions for taking care of the environment rather than penalizing them. But nevertheless, higher taxes here than there, higher wages here than there, more lawsuits here than there, more government regulations here than there, more environmental restrictions here than there, and crony capitalism, where you have the president and administration giving tax benefits, Obamacare waivers, favorable treatment to certain companies that play along and support him and his agenda. And then those that don't support him, they don't get those benefits, the Hobby Lobbies that don't get the breaks from Obamacare, and they have a choice. They either can go out of the country or go out of business. And so the companies that want to at least stay in business, they are forced to move out of the country just to stay competitive globally. And so once you raise the taxes and the government regulations and the higher wages and more restrictions and so forth, yes, you're going to see businesses leave, and they're going to take their jobs with them. And then we're going to have higher unemployment. Now, you could look at it from one angle and think, gee, this is so irresponsible of our government doing this. That's one side. The other side is, no, they're doing exactly what they want to do. And it's the Cloward-Piven strategy. Our president went to Columbia University. Two professors at Columbia University were Richard Cloward, Francis Piven, and they came up with a way of backdooring countries into socialism by causing their economies to crater and causing as many people to be out of work as possible. The people then get on welfare and food stamps, and they will always vote for the party that promises more handouts, and they end up surrendering their lives, and the government takes over control of their lives without firing a shot. So there's two ways to have a totalitarian government. One is they march in with tanks and kill. The other is you bankrupt people into dependency. This is the Cloward-Piven strategy. Those familiar with the Bible story, there's 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine in Egypt. That first year of famine, people said, we don't have food, government, take our cattle, give us food. Second year, take our land, give us food. Third year, take us and our kids and our posterity, just give us a handout. And all the power in Egypt was concentrated into the hands of one person, the Pharaoh. And so if your goal is to be the Pharaoh and you had it within your power to put people out of work intentionally, then they'll all sign up for welfare and food stamps. And there's a pretty interesting human quality of selfishness. It is the most powerful underlying quality of every human being. If you study history, it's admitted to. And so imagine if you were getting a $1,000 check in the mail every week, year after year. Would you finally one day said, you know, I'm going to find out who is sending me this $1,000 check and vote them out of office?
Never. I've got a different spin on it, though. I think some of our taxation is directly related to the breakdown of the family, that it seems like we've never had more messed up situations where it's not even just people getting divorced, it's people who don't ever get married, and yet they can bear children as if they are married with nobody really taking responsibility because the government will do that. So we've got moral decay going on at the same time, and you might say, what is causing, I'll ask you, is the moral decay coming because government is propping up people if they don't get married, or is it the opposite? Are people just choosing to live that way and then government is trying to cater to whatever the most popular lifestyle is?
That definitely is one way of looking at it. Another way is deconstruction is a communist term, and it basically is you have to take a car from drive into neutral before you go into reverse. In other words, you have to separate a people from their past, get them into a neutral where they're not attached to anything before you can take them into your communist future. Sort of like a salesman gets you to doubt and stop using the product that you've been using for years. You're still using that product, man, you are so old fashioned. And then you say, well, what's wrong with it? And so you stop using it. And then you're into this neutral, well, gee, what should I do? Let me look at everything. And then they say, well, you know what, you really need this new product. And then you're attached. So it's a detach, unattached, and then reattached. And so in China, for example, the communists had a cultural revolution where they trashed 5,000 years of Chinese culture. They killed everybody that had a college degree. Doctors, lawyers, teachers, missionaries, anybody that wore glasses was killed in the 1950s in China. And so they had this uneducated mass of young people that they could brainwash into the People's Republic of China. And so the idea is you have to get people to let go of their past. And Norman Lear said, you make people laugh at what they hold sacred. He's the Saturday Night Live writer, you know, guy. And so it's this idea that if people are patriotic and they honor the founders of our country, they're going to honor the country that the founders set up and want to preserve it. But if you can detach them emotionally from those people and make them look like a bunch of slave owners and white misogynists, you know, and all kinds of intolerant people, then you can say, gee, you know, I don't want to attach to them, and so I guess I'm in this neutral. And then they can come along and say, well, hey, join this new, you know, communist movement. Or Europe is actually, you know, they're moving from a Judeo-Christian past to a French Revolution and the secular neutral, and Napoleon spread the secularism around. But now Europe's going into reverse with Sharia law Islam and, you know, taking over whole areas there. And the Europeans are having, you know, like one kid per couple, and grandparents are fighting over the kid, and where the Muslims are having eight kids per family, and then they're signing them all up for welfare, and the guy has his harem, and each wife, you know, gets her own welfare checks, and he collects the checks and lives like a king while he's spreading Islam all day long, and so the Europeans are paying to Islamify themselves.
Very, very, you know, thank you for bringing out the striking stories, because this is something that we need to know about. And I had a customer come in my bookstore today, and I was running the cash register, and she said, so what are you doing now? And when I told her I'm not holding any public office, she said, why not? And I believe, not to make anybody feel bad, but the only honest answer is we're going into a time when it is going to be impossible for Christians to get elected to office. We are seeing that last November was a really a devastating day for good people. We are looking at, even though I lost, I was in good company with Todd Akin, who lost. Jim Lemke lost his Senate seat, and he was the incumbent. Ed Martin lost. Shane Scholer. It was an open seat for Secretary of State, and even with it being open, he couldn't win that. I have a friend from Indiana named Cindy Noe, who was the incumbent. She lost her seat. We are watching the wrath of God on our state and nation, and we're right before our very eyes. We're watching a time when I fear that my grandchildren will someday ask me, Grandma, how was it possible for you to get elected as a Christian? Like, did you have to keep that a secret or something? I mean,
well, no, and you're pointing out a very important point. I know we've just got a few minutes left here, but the gay agenda equals a war on Christianity. That in a nutshell, you strip away the marriage part of it, really all the gay agenda is a creative way to declare war on Christianity. They don't line up at the Justice of the Peace. They make a beeline to the preschool, begin indoctrinating little children. And here, where Christian morality says there's a commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, they're teaching them to experiment. And we say it's sacred and safe for marriage, and they say, well, you know, you can do it with anybody. And then, you know, we say that God made you special, and they say, if there is a God, he's so confused, he's putting men in women's bodies. I mean, you know, and then Jesus said, if you cause one of these little ones to stumble, it's better that a millstone be put around your neck and you throw in the depths of the sea. Yet that's exactly what they're teaching in the schools. But the big thing is when the military is completely homosexualized.
Bill,
right
will, you
now,
let me come back on the show again, and let's get into this topic, because we've only barely scratched the surface, and it's not fair to you or the listeners to tease us like this. Can we do it again?
I'd love to.
Okay, and if anybody wants to catch you, they can go to AmericanMinute.com.
AmericanMinute.com, the book I wrote called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States, and then two DVDs. One is Islamic Conquest, Past and Present, and then the other is Political Islam's War on the West.
Thanks, Bill. We appreciate you. We'll get in touch again and bring you back on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate you, Cynthia.
All right.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.